Avengers Age of Ultron is over, but we're just getting started here on the Avengers Age of Ultron podcast on post-show recaps. It's happening. I'm Josh Wigler. We're here to talk some Marvel today. It's going to be a very good time. I'm joined here today by two very awesome people who are going to be walking through the Marvel Cinematic Universe with me. Up first, you know him from the Daredevil podcast, and if you don't, then you didn't listen to the Daredevil podcast, and that's on you. That's your fault. But when the two of us form together, you are shipping Wahadeo. It's me. It's Kevin Mahadeo. We're Wahadeo. Kevin, how's it going?
It's going good. I don't know if I like Wahadeo. How about Migler? Migler's good.
Does that make you want to mlare when you hear Wahadeo?
Yes, it makes me want to mlare all over the place.
Yeah, it doesn't make you feel good. Next, we've got another guy making his debut in poster recaps. Very excited about this. Very good friend of mine. Someone you ought to know by name if you're a comic book fan, if you pay attention to comic book news. He's the associate editor of Comic Book Resources. He's the writer of the fantastic In Your Face Jam column. By far and away the biggest X-Force fan on the planet. It's Brett White. Brett, how's it going?
Totally tubular.
Totally tubular. That's a fair thing to say, though. Would you say you're probably the biggest X-Force fan on the planet?
I mean, specifically 90s X-Force. The problem is that the franchise has gotten so diluted with later editions that I have to clarify.
Yeah, see, there you go, everybody. That's all you need to know.
That's a taste of what you're in for.
That's
from
a taste
me.
Of what you're oh, in boy. For from Brett. Brett is fantastic. Those of you who listen to the Daredevil podcast know that I worked with Kevin Mahadeo at Wizard Magazine once upon a time. Same is true for the two of us and Brett. Brett worked at Wizard as well. I think, Brett, you survived at Wizard longer than any of us.
You guys both left me, but not. I mean, like,
well,
that
I voluntarily left.
Yeah, not all of us by choice.
Not all of us by choice. But for the people who don't know you yet, Brett, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your history with comics, your history with talking about comics, all that good stuff.
I got into comics when I was in third grade because of the X-Men cartoon series on Fox. I remember watching Night of the Sentinels when it aired the first time and being like, what is this? It's not G.I. Joe. I don't like this. And then I changed my mind and never went back. And I've been writing for Comic Book Resources since 2011.
A while.
I think 2011.
A while. Yeah, definitely a while. And your column that you do over there is called In Your Face Jam. What do you write about?
It's kind of a catch-all of whatever I want to. And whatever I want to is usually trying to calm people down by explaining that, like, comics should be for everybody. Diversity is pretty awesome. And then a lot of writing about X-Men.
but you wrote about Avengers recently, which is why we're all here. We're all here to talk about the new Avengers movie that came out. But you wrote something that really spoke to me about Avengers and how the movie Avengers are your Avengers. And this was actually something that kind of took me off guard. I have to admit, knowing that you have such like a deep history as a comic book fan, but I guess you're not like the biggest Avengers comic book fan necessarily.
No, as I explained in my article, I mean, the reason the X-Men were so popular in the early 90s is because, like, they had that cartoon, they had the A-list talent on them, and because that Marvel never wanted to mess with their momentum, so they kept putting all the great creators on that book, and then, by default, all the other Marvel books really suffered. So if you go back and look at the Avengers in the 90s, you're going to see, like, Wasp, who's actually a bug, or, like, Scarlet Witch wearing a bikini, like... just crazy things. So as a kid, I was like, the Avengers just seemed like Marvel's attempt at trying to like copy the X-Men.
Right.
Like trying to just like take what was working with the X-Men, throw it on the Avengers. It never worked. The movies in 2012 is where I really was like, oh, I get this now. I get why this is good.
Right. When all of the individual franchise teamed up for one mega franchise. And now we're here 3 years later. They've done it again. So we've all seen this by now. Brett, Kevin and I, we've all seen.
Wait. We were supposed to watch the movie first.
Kevin, did you not do it? Did you not?
Oh, God. No, I definitely did.
Classic Kevin just screwing things up again. But no, we've all seen it. Brett has seen it twice.
Yeah.
Brett's the best at doing his homework. I have seen it once. I saw it a couple of days ago. I wrote a review about it for digitaltrends.com where I used the word awesome 9 times. So that should tell you how I felt about the movie. Kevin, what was your take on Avengers?
One, I'm very upset at Joss Whedon about a certain scene we can talk about later. But at the same time, not surprising. He is known for killing your hopes and dreams, I guess, for certain things. But I loved it. It makes me angry because it was so good at times. But God, it's like being a kid in that movie theater, just watching certain scenes. You just get giddy and excited.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll just give the prerequisite spoiler warning. If you were not already sure if you were walking into spoilers or not, this isn't like a spoiler free recommendation of the Avengers Age of Ultron. This is straight up. We're going into it. We're talking about everything. Spoiler alert. Because Kevin was talking about how Quicksilver gets killed.
So, yes. Oh man, I really hope people cut off their box.
I'm just dropping that bomb. Dropping that bomb. I'm just Veronica-ing that shit. So that's the thing that happens. It's a big movie, you know. It's you know, these superhero movies, you don't always think that these, you know, big kind of universe altering moments can necessarily happen. And, you know, to say that Quicksilver's death was a universe altering moment, I don't know if I'd go that far, but he's a recognizable name in comics to a lot of fans. He gets wiped off.
Even to moviegoers who saw him in a movie last year.
Exactly.
Yes, in Days of Future Past.
Exactly. But, you know, we're used to some of this to an extent. You know, Phil Coulson gets killed off in the first Avengers movie, and then he gets his own TV show, so he's not really dead. I feel like Quicksilver is actually dead through this movie. What do you think, Brett?
I mean, you know, the great thing about the Marvel Universe and coming from comics, we saw a lot of this in like Winter Soldier, Marvel is not afraid of doing like crazy comic book stuff, like resurrections and reveals, and like Toby Jones is a person inside of a computer. Like,
right,
they're not afraid of doing crazy stuff but still grounding it. So I'm like, I don't know, Quicksilver is dead, but if that character is really popular, they want to bring him back, pump him full of some Inhuman blood, and then he's back.
That's all.
I mean, it's definitely possible, I guess. I don't know. I the joke obviously when it happens is, bet you didn't see that coming. And I'm like, I didn't, because like you kind of like in Joss Whedon's, he sets up this like, oh, maybe he'll definitely kill Hawkeye, because you can't put it past Joss Whedon. Everything he does, he murders someone you love. And so I should have gone in knowing that, oh, yeah, I really like Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, that one of them was probably going to get murdered. And when it happened, I was still shocked. And yeah, just I should have known. I'm a huge Joss Whedon fan. He always does it to me, always. And this was no exception.
All right. Well, we'll get into all of that later in the podcast. We've got a bunch of questions from you guys who sent questions in. Quicksilver was a hot topic of conversation from what you guys wrote in, but there's plenty of other stuff to talk about firsthand. And I think just kind of springboarding off of something you said a minute ago, Kevin, was just like the experience of watching this movie in the theater. You know, a few weeks ago, I did kind of this epic post-show recaps podcast about the Fast and Furious franchise with Mike Bloom, and it was basically, I had never seen these movies before, so I was catching up and racing to get to Furious 7. Yeah, you know, I was speeding along trying to get to Furious 7 on time for the movie to come out, and so that was the first one that I'd seen in a crowd. And seeing that movie in a big packed theater of people and like hearing people react to just the madness of the Fast and Furious franchise was a really awesome feeling. I've obviously been able to feel that with the Marvel movies. I've been, you know, watching the Marvel movies since they first came out with Iron Man in 2008, and everything moving forward, I haven't skipped one. And every time, it's just like it's a hootin' and hollering experience. Everybody in the theater is pretty lit up. Brett, what was your experience? Because we haven't said this on the podcast. Many people probably don't know that one of the two times you went to see the movie as of this recording was at Marvel had a screening. It wasn't a press screening. It was the Marvel company.
For their freelancers.
Yeah. But Brett does some freelance work for Marvel.com, and so you got to see it in a big packed house of Marvel people, Marvel creators, writers, artists, employees, their friends, their families. What was it like seeing Avengers Age of Ultron in that kind of crowd? How did the movie play with the family?
Fine. I'm going to say, like, I was underwhelmed by both of my theater experiences.
Wow.
And I think that it's because my experience seeing Avengers 1 in 2012 at midnight in New York City, on Thursday at midnight when it opened, was by far and away the most intense, extreme, joyous occasion. Like, it raised the bar up to 11, that even if that Marvel crowd I just saw this one with was at an 8, it felt like a 2. Because that the screening 3 years ago was like a rock concert. It was that, like, everyone was so on board and invested and screaming. I was full throat screaming at the movie theater for parts of the first Avengers movie, and everyone else was doing the same. Like, there was no shame in my game because everyone else was there with me.
Right.
Both the screenings I was at, like, I was the only one ridiculously, like, bouncing my legs up and down and clapping and giggling.
with this one.
Yeah,
I think like one. it's a matter of because like the first movie when it first comes out, I think all of us were also waiting with like bated breath, like kind of like, oh my God, did they do it? Did they do it? Because like that was that moment where it could have all fallen apart, and we were just ecstatic they did it. We were like, oh my God, they succeeded. This movie's amazing. It's everything we hoped for. It's everything we wanted. And so with the second one, I mean, I loved it. I mean, my experience was much better, I guess, than yours. But like, I understand what you're saying, because I think for the second one, it's just like, oh yeah, we knew they did it the first time, so like less is riding on it more, so to speak. And like from the trailer, I think people went in expecting like, oh, this is gonna be good. So I think maybe it was that, is just there was so much more riding on that first film.
In the first film, there were like huge applause breaks just for Captain America and Iron Man being on the screen together. Yes, like that was, I mean, both screenings I did, like the big jokes hit. I mean, like, spoiler alert, the Vision holding Mjolnir reveal for in this movie is kind of like the Hulk smashing Loki around in the first movie. Like that moment hit so hard both times, like gasping, like like minds being blown because Vision just picked up Mjolnir. Like,
yeah, same here. Amazing response to that scene.
Yeah, for sure. And I kind of wonder, well, first off, just to editorialize for a second, if any of you guys become friends with Brett White after this podcast, I highly recommend going to see a Marvel movie with him, because I saw Captain America, the Winter Soldier. And I was sitting, I was sitting next to Brett, and I've never sat next to anybody happier to be at a movie than I have when I saw that movie with Brett. I highly recommend the experience. Boy. He really is the giddiest man in the room. It's amazing. Let me just blow up your spot right there, Brett. But I think that this is actually we're touching on something kind of interesting that I've been noticing is, well, just the quick gut check, just a yes or no. Kevin, you loved this movie.
Yes.
Brett, you loved this movie.
Yes.
I did as well. There are people I think that didn't love this movie. There are people who walked away saying, I liked it.
You know? Yeah. Listen, there's people who walked out of Dark Knight, or at least a couple days later after a receive much critical fanfare, that said it was okay. Well, there's always going to be those people, and those people are wrong.
no one's right or wrong, but I feel like I'm hearing this from a lot of Marvel fans. You know, I'm hearing this from people who really enjoyed the Marvel movies.
Yes.
And Brett, you're even talking about being in a room filled with Marvel people, and the reaction was tepid, just be because you were surrounded by grownups, rather than, you know, a real kid friendly crowd necessarily. But it seems like maybe the reaction to this movie is more subdued, and maybe it has something to do with what you're talking about, Kevin, where like we were waiting with the first Avengers film to see if a movie starring Iron Man and Captain America and Thor, if a dude with a bow and arrow could fit into that picture, you know, without it being ridiculous, like, could this work? And it worked extremely, extremely well, so much so that it's the third highest grossing film of all time. We'll see if that changes after this movie. But now a lot of that surprise is gone. You know, we know that it works. So what do you do now? How do you wow us now? And maybe the movie just didn't wow some people.
I mean, I had like a 2-hour long conversation with one of my friends last night. And it seems like the main critique that I hear about this movie, which is the one that I do agree with, because I think that more so than any Marvel movie before this one, this is really going to divide between people that are into the Marvel Cinematic Universe for the universe aspect of it and people that just want to go see a normal film, which is why I don't think critics are responding to this movie as well, because critics are evaluating it both on its own merits as a standalone film and then also against the first Avengers. The first Avengers is very simple plot, very A to B, like it gets the job done and it's perfect. I love it. This movie is so dense and so packed with so much stuff. It almost feels like at times its own awesomeness is like the cross it's bearing in a way.
Just like very, very casually dropping a Wakanda reference that's going to go over half the audience's head.
Thor goes to a scrying pool for like, no, to normal people, like Thor goes to a scrying pool for no reason. And it's all this random Asgardian stuff. But for me, I'm like, okay, cool. so I get that criticism. And I think it's something interesting that, you know, Marvel has to discuss going forward. Like, can they, what is the balance between satisfying the hardcore intense fans and what is the balance between making movies that stand alone when fans kind of only get excited about like Easter eggs and like call forwards and hints and, you know,
well, look,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah, Kevin, go.
I mean, I get what you guys are saying. I think you're absolutely right, but I think it's also, I don't know, they're looking at these movies wanting, like, okay, Avengers, they want to be like a good standalone movie, but that's not what Avengers are. If you want to compare it to like the comic book world, the Avengers movie is a crossover. So some crossover, where at that point, you're not looking for individuals' movies anymore. You look at the actual individual movies for an individual story being told, and that's what you get. Like, Captain America 2 is actually probably the best solidly done movie Marvel has produced. Like, it's an actual great film. But like, when you go to watch Avengers, you're not going to watch that. You're going to watch these people team up and have a bombastic summer adventure. And that's what these movies are. And I know critics generally, a lot of like hardcore critics, you know, snob the big blockbuster action films. But I think Avengers succeeds a lot better than other action films do, because it still has story and character and, you know, heart to it.
Do I need to go on my anti-Furious 7 rant right now?
No.
Please.
It was a really good movie. I liked it a lot. But like, guys, those movies aren't like, those are summer blockbuster movies.
Yeah, for sure. No, I agree with you 100%.
Like, they have like one-dimensional characters that pay lip service to relationships. Guys, Vin Diesel's a horrible actor.
No, stop it. That is Groot you're talking about. Be quiet. No,
that's Iron Giant as well. Watch it, Brett.
Brett, we'll have you back on post-show recaps to give your anti-Furious 7 podcast at some point down the line. Let's stay on topic here.
Still enjoy the movie, but I'm saying, like, with Avengers Age of Ultron, like, seeing it twice, Joss Whedon is a master storyteller, and there's so much nuance and subtlety to all the characters and the tiny arcs that he gives them to play that is so rewarding upon multiple viewings that... That's not what's in summer blockbusters normally. So, like, underneath all the punching, you have, like, subtle stuff about, like, Bruce Banner's desire versus the Hulk's desire, like, what those two characters want and how they contrast with each other. Or you get, like, Captain America having to come to terms with the fact that he can't go home. Like, he can't fall in love. He's committed to the mission. As Ultron says, he always needs a war. Like, there's all this subtle stuff. That's so great.
Yeah, no, there definitely is. And I think that that's kind of the interesting thing we're touching on, is there's a lot of that in play. You know, there's a lot of great character moments. There's a lot of really interesting storylines that are being played out between Black Widow and Hulk, you know, between Hawkeye and his family that we had no idea existed.
His family, including Lindsay Ware from friggin' Freaks and Geeks, man.
Linda Carnelia. It was a really great reveal, and there's just lots of really good reveals going on. But then there's also a lot of stuff that does feel like it's in service of what's coming next. You know, a lot of setting up the board for where the Marvel Cinematic Universe is going. And I think I don't remember which one of you said that, but it's the cross that these movies have to bear is. What Marvel is doing is fairly groundbreaking in terms of the modern blockbuster, weaving this very complicated universe of individual franchises that intersect into these larger Avengers movies. And from what we know about the future, the next, Ant-Man is coming out this summer, but after that, the next Marvel movie on the board is called Captain America Civil War, but it may as well, it seems like, be called Avengers 2.5, where...
New Avengers.
That's literally what I said, you know, like, as I walked out of the theater.
Where you know, a lot of what we'll see in Captain America Civil War, for people who don't necessarily know what that's going to be about, is Iron Man will be in that movie. Captain America obviously is in that movie. It's going to take a lot of cues, probably, but not all of the cues, from a comic book run called Civil War, where Iron Man and Captain America are no longer friends. Lots of superheroes on different sides of the aisle. We'll see Black Widow pop up again. We'll see
Odds are it's going to be the team at the end of the movie, because...
Well, who knows?
Anthony Mackie and Elizabeth Olsen and Scarlett Johansson are all confirmed for the movie.
Exactly. So a bunch of the people that we see at the end of this one are going to be popping up in the next, you know, in the next movie, in Civil War, which is just a year from now. We're basically getting an Avengers 2 sequel a year from now, which is insane to think about. But a lot of this movie, I think, does have to kind of ride the line between satisfying the narratives and the arcs and the payoffs within this movie, and also setting up what's to come next. And it's a really difficult act, because I walked into this movie not expecting there to be much about the cosmic universe. You know, the Thanos reveal at the end of the first Avengers movie was such an amazing thing, where he turns around after the other says to court them is to court death, and he gives you the big grin. Yeah. And then you kind of, before Marvel announced at Comic-Con a couple years ago that the next movie would be called Age of Ultron, most people, myself included, assumed that Thanos would be the big bad of Avengers 2. Turns out, no, we're setting him up for what we now know to be called Avengers Infinity War. It's going to be a two-part movie that's going to start in 2018 and finish in 2019. That's where Thanos is going to be. And now we've got Age of Ultron, which is, it seems like it will be a much more grounded movie. And that was my expectation walking into this, that we weren't going to get much Thanos at all. You know, we got a little bit of him in Guardians of the Galaxy. That's a little bit of the chessboard moving that we've got going on there. I didn't think that we would get much of him here at all, beyond maybe that, you know, post-credit scene, which we'll talk about because that was amazing. But the movie actually does put pieces into position for what's coming next. You know, Thor's entire storyline really in this movie is to set up the next Avengers movie.
Yeah. Well, it's to set up, I think, Thor 3. Like, when he talks about going back to Asgard and investigating, I'm like, oh, so that's what Thor 3 is going to be about.
Right.
Like,
he's setting that up. He's setting up Thor 3. You know, a lot of the visions of the apocalypse that he seems to be seeing tie directly into an event
called
Ragnarok. Yep. That's going to be the subtitle of the next Thor movie, is Thor Ragnarok. So it's setting up Thor 3. A lot of the divisions that we're seeing between Captain America and Iron Man is setting up Captain America Civil War. But a lot of this stuff is also setting up Avengers 3 and 4. So there's a lot of balancing and a lot of juggling that this movie has to do. You know, it's hard enough for sequels to, you know, sequels that we know are going to get sequels. It's hard enough for those movies to be satisfying on their own. But for a movie like this to be satisfying on its own, while not only having to set up another sequel, but to be like responsible for setting up many sequels, like different individual sequels to all the individual characters in the
also
movie.
Also, like Black Panther gets set up in this movie. Like, there's
it's
so much.
It's a tough act, and I do think that it is worth wondering, you know, for some people, like, is it too much? Like, is it too hard to do? For me, I loved it, but I can't call myself, you know, a strictly casual viewer. I think the three of us, I would say, and I take no shame in saying this, that I'm the least comic book versed of the three people talking right now. I'm the closest to a casual among the three of us. But for people who have no knowledge of that stuff, is it too much, or do you kind of just get washed away and swept up in the awesome spectacle in front of you?
Well, Josh, look, I mean, okay, what Marvel's doing here, that like, when you're telling a story, right, you need to know your big beats in the story. You need to know your beginning, you need to know the beat in the middle, and you need to know your end. Now, some of that stuff can change along the way, but having a solid story structure is very important to executing the whole story. Marvel has done that. Marvel has come up with the intro was leading up to the first Avengers, and they executed it. Once that was done, they basically were just like, all right, all in. And so everything they're doing, they've planned out. Like, the whole setup, the fact that they're doing that, the fact that they're laying these threads like this to Avengers 3, to the future movies, is proper storytelling, because they're not just telling one story.
Yeah.
They're telling one giant story with many little stories in between. And I think what Marvel is doing here is putting faith in their reader. And I think that's very important, because a lot of other movies and franchises and stuff, they don't do that. They look down on almost a viewer and just are like, eh, we have to over explain things, we have to kind of baby walk them. And Marvel's like, no, we have faith in these people. If they stuck through the first Iron Man, the first Cap, the first Thor, and they made to Avengers, at that end credit, the hardcore fans were like, oh snap, Thanos. Everyday people were like, I don't know who that is, but I'm gonna go look it up, because Marvel had faith that people at the end, if they loved it, were gonna go find out who that guy was, and they did. And that's what's going to happen here. Every step of the way, the fans are engaged. They want to know more. Yeah. And that's the proper way to do this. And that's what they've been doing. And I don't think it's overwhelming. I think I'm going to put faith. I'm going to be like Captain America and have faith in people here. And I think that they can, you know, they can handle it.
Stop trying to be the Hulk of this podcast, because we know who you really are.
I do think that there is. I mean, I remember when I saw Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, the guy after when it ended, the guy behind me was like, wait a second, there's another one. Like,
no, that's great.
I think there are definitely I think that the main criticism of this movie all boils down to personal preference in a way, because I think I love the intricate storytelling and calling forward things, I don't mind. Like, if you're going to have a guy in a salvage yard, make it Claw. Like, why not? Like, make it a character that seeds something else instead of just like a generic bad guy. Like, make it Claw, make all that stuff. But then there are other people that, I don't know, they don't want that. And those are a lot of critics, it seems like.
Sure. But like, the everyday person has no idea who Lysis Claw is. He will when if they go see Black Panther. I think
how about the people who are listening to this right now? Who is that? Who are you guys even talking about right now?
Andy Serkis's big, beefy, bearded, Brooklyn hipster-looking, South African-talking salvage yard bad guy who gets his arm cut off.
Yeah, and why is he important? Why do people need to know who that guy is?
He is Black Panther, who has a movie coming in 2018?
2017. Yeah.
And he's also going to be in Captain America Civil War, played by Chadwick Boseman of mini biopic fame.
Yes.
He is Black Panther's number one enemy. He gets his arm cut off because in the comic books he has like a weird sonic ray gun blaster thing for an arm.
Yeah, I was so excited when that happened in the movie too, when his arm got cut off. I'm like, yes, they're setting it up. Like, that's a fan moment, right?
Right.
And then to someone that doesn't know it, watching it, you're just seeing like a generic bad guy getting his hand cut off, which is not out of place. Like that, it makes total sense within the context, I think, whether you know it or don't know it.
Yeah. I love it. I personally do. And I think that most people love it as well because, you know, people vote with their money and they're giving all of their money to these movies. So, you know, people are at least into figuring it out or at least interested enough. I know that there's a lot of people who think it's too complicated. A lot of people who've written into us, in fact. But I really like it. And I hear what you're saying, Kevin. I like that they're, you know, kind of trusting the reader, as you call them, but the viewer, you know, they trust the people who are going to see these movies to take it upon themselves, and if they don't know the answers, to seek them out, to ask their friends, to look online, to buy some comics. That would be nice. Go buy some comics today, by the way. It's free comic book day.
Yeah,
as we're recording this.
Yeah, free comic book day. Go out.
It's very likely that it is no longer free comic book day as you are listening to this, but as we were recording. But you know, for me, maybe there is a line between doing the Thanos thing at the end of Avengers and then having your sequel be loaded with Thanos moments. You know, like every other scene, it feels like one of those Thanos moments. And I think that it could be overwhelming for some people. I think that, you know, it's a lot to keep track of. But maybe at this point, what's cool about Marvel is they are operating under the assumption that they've got you. You're in the theater, first of all, very, you know, physically in the theater, but you're coming to the theater because you're into these movies. You're into finding out more about these things. You're into seeing Iron Man in a context that you normally don't see him when we're talking about an Iron Man movie, which tend to be more or less grounded. Maybe not so much by Iron Man 3 when people are like exploding their bodies with extremist technology. Maybe we've gone a little further away from the first Iron Man movie, but it's fun to see Tony Stark going through a wormhole and appearing on the opposite end of the galaxy and then coming back and falling down to Earth. You know, that's what these Avengers movies can do. And Marvel feels the confidence now, can puff their chest out enough and say, like, you're into that, so let's throw a whole bunch of other shit at you and see how that lands.
Well, yeah, it's the slow pacing that stuff out too, right? Like, you want to, like, fantasy is a tough subject for a lot of people. Sci-fi and fantasy usually don't, quote-unquote, do well. But you tease it out slowly. It's the reason why, spoilers for Game of Thrones first season, you don't show dragons until the very, very end. Because even the book reader, I read that, and I it was very low fantasy, quote-unquote, for me, because it doesn't have the magical and mystical elements. But then they start teasing it out slowly, and you get into it, as opposed to just sometimes just dropping a casual viewer or a regular person into that world can be overwhelming. So they've been pacing it out slowly, and heck, soon we're gonna have magic showing up. So, you know, we kind of had some, I guess, in this, but yeah.
All right, so let's start diving into the movie in specific. Let's start getting into some of the characters and the stories that we see on screen. Where do you want to start, Brett? What's your favorite aspect character wise of the movie? I know that's a hard thing to ask because there's probably a lot, but where would you want to start? What do you think is for you, like, what's the thing that you're still thinking about character wise leaving Age of Ultron?
Well, I mean, Black Widow is my favorite movie superhero, period, of all time, of any franchise ever. And I have had a lot of thinking about what she does in this movie and how there's a thing of like the word trope gets thrown around almost like the word racist in a way. It's like the nerd version of racist. Well, no, because nerds are also racist a lot of the time, too.
Whoa.
I mean, people throw trope around, and it's a very loaded word that is like meant to elicit like anger. Like, how dare you use that trope? You just use nothing but tropes, you know?
But tropes can be good in storytelling.
And yeah, exactly. Like,
it's a trope.
It's a trope. The tropes are good in storytelling. And there's a lot with Black Widow's role in this movie that is very tropey. But also, it's like wrestling with that, but then also acknowledging the way that subverts it. Like, Black Widow gets, air quote, damseled in the movie because she does, if you're going by strict reading of the trope, she does get kidnapped. But I think it's a disservice to say that female characters can never get kidnapped. And also, the reason Black Widow gets kidnapped is because she single-handedly saves the Vision in South Korea.
Right, yeah.
She does that.
She puts herself out in front of everybody else like and manhandles Ultron, like, the situation.
It's not like Ultron came into her apartment and stole her to make the men mad. She was a badass. And then also, when she gets captured, she's also the instrument of her own rescue, because she uses her spy skills to contact Hawkeye, which then alerts them to where Ultron's headquarters is, which sets up the entire third act of the movie.
Right. Yeah, so which, like, I think is important. Like, the fact that she is her own savior is very important and kind of, you know, plays against the quote-unquote trope, as you said. Like, that's the difference.
So it's like the trope is there, but it is bookended by things that subvert the trope and also don't demean the character. The other thing is the whole, like, she's sterile thing.
Yes. Which, yeah, to get into that, we had a question sent in from Rachel Wagner, who said, so we learned some pretty horrific details about Black Widow's past, especially forced sterilization. Why do you think they did that? Do you think to make her a more appealing match for Banner or for her character arc in the MCU? Where do you see her going next? What did you think about that, Brett?
I think that, first of all, it is a trope to always tie female action heroes to maternity, like Aliens. Sigourney Weaver's whole arc is all about Newt and like mother instincts, you know, because like she found out her daughter died in a deleted scene that wasn't in the final movie, was it?
No, that's in the extended cut.
So like there is this, so that is a trope. But the way I viewed that scene was, Black Widow isn't admitting that she wants kids, which I've seen some people take that as that. Black Widow is admitting that she had this horrible thing done to her. I think that she's more traumatized by the violation, which is brought up in her mind by the Scarlet Witch's manipulation. I don't think she cares about having kids. And I think that this is reinforced by the fact that at the end of the movie, when her and Banner finally kiss and he's like, let's run away, you know, let's go be together, she kisses him and then turns him into the Hulk by pushing him off a cliff.
Right.
And she says, I need the other guy. That's Black Widow saying she wants to be in love, she wants to have a relationship, but that is not more important than the mission.
Yeah, which it's time to go to work.
Totally in character and totally in line with everything we've seen from her before, and especially following Winter Soldier, where at the end of that movie, she says, all my covers are blown. She is totally public. She's in totally uncharted territory. She has to deal with all the horrible things of her past. And I'm glad that we get to see her do that in this movie. Now, I hope that we've seen all of that in this movie, and then in Civil War, we get to see her be a more whole person. Like, this is the most broken she's been. So I kind of want to see her in Civil War, like, getting her groove back, getting a bit more focused, you know?
Yeah. Kevin, did you like the romance storyline between Natasha and Bruce? This is not, you know, a big comic book storyline, right?
No, they do not have a thing in the comics. I liked it. I mean, look, part of me was very excited when they introduced Winter Soldier in Cap 2, because part of me knew they wasn't going to be completely like that, because her, you know, Natasha and the Winter Soldier, Bucky, actually have a relationship in the comics. And so part of me was like, oh, maybe that'll get set up. But the fact that they are not doing that and doing the Hulk is fine by me. The fact that they're doing her and Cap is fine by me. I don't have a quote-unquote OTP for a lot of people. So, like, I really liked the play between, you know, Banner and her, and, like, the fact that they both look at themselves, because, like, Natasha, I think, to a certain extent, looks at herself as a monster because of the things she's done. She's murdered so many people. She's done these terrible things. And I think the bond between her and, Bruce Banner and the Hulk is phenomenal because of that, because they both have these sides of them that they fear and, I think, to a certain extent, need to embrace. And I think that's ultimately what ruined that relationship, is that Bruce doesn't want to embrace the Hulk side of him. He's terrified of it. He hates it. Whereas she realizes she sort of needs that part of her. You know, she needs that part of her to complete the mission. And I think that's where the relationship fell apart. That said, that sort of sets up a Hulk storyline for the future about Banner and whether or not he should embrace the Hulk. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a great story beat. I think it's great storytelling the way they did it.
And Mark Ruffalo and Scarlett Johansson together were just terrific.
Also, oh God, the Mark fact that every- they... the fact that they got to be paired together on the press tour.
Yeah, sure.
So delightful. My two favorite people. I loved every minute of it.
No, they're amazing. You know, they're both really good. They are two of the Avengers that don't have their own film franchises right now, hopefully someday in the future. But, you know, that was one of the things that I thought was really awesome about this movie is that they were kind of the beating heart of the movie was the connection between Bruce and Natasha. And I think it really worked. And that's another thing that I think is great about, you know, in retrospect about the first Avengers, now that you can kind of go back and you can think about the first Avengers and storylines that were being explored there. And I don't know how much of that was set up for what we see here, but just think about the first time you see Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner in the first movie. It's, you know, in a scene with Natasha where like she's been sent to go and get him. And, you know, it's a very tense scene because you don't know if he's going to Hulk out and if he's going to be a danger to her, but she's really cool under the pressure. You know, there's the big scene where he hulks out on the helicarrier when the helicarrier is going down and he's ripping up hallways and corridors on his way to kind of smash whatever's in sight, and unfortunately she's in sight. There's that big moment at the end of the movie right before he says I'm always angry, where she says we could use a little worse. So there's connections there that you can kind of now go back and look at in the context of what you see in Age of Ultron, knowing that they are more than friends. There's something brewing. There's something developing there. And you can, you know, kind of retroactively look at the first Avengers movie and the scenes between Widow and Hulk, and it adds some new context there. And that's the kind of thing that I love these movies setting up, that maybe we don't have any read on yet. You know, people looked at Hawkeye and Widow in that first movie as maybe there was a romantic thing brewing there. Turns out they're just like super BFF.
Yeah. So great.
To the point that Widow's the only person that knows about Hawkeye's secret family and like
a
knows
platonic mixed gender relationship where there's like just a guy and a girl who are best friends and there's nothing beyond that.
It's great. It's great. I think that this movie really did those three characters extremely well. Oh, and what a relief for Hawkeye. Because, Hawkeye on paper, if you were judging, you know, based only on his power set such that it is, if you're judging based on how he appeared in the Avengers, which is basically not as himself, it's really easy to walk away from that first movie and say, well, that guy is the worst, clearly. In the power rankings of the six Avengers, it's Hawkeye, and then you can fight for 1 through 5. After this movie, that's difficult to say. This is a question we got in from Brian Gold, who hadn't even seen the movie as he sent this question, and he was sitting in the theater waiting for it to start. But he said, can you guys just talk about how much of a badass Hawkeye is? Because hearing he's a badass in the movie. And Brian, as a testament to his comic book cred, spelled it Hawk Guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which this is movie, how he is referred to in a great run of Hawkeye comics recently.
When Linda Cardellini's character, Laura Barton, like had that talk with him about like, you know, you need to make sure this team has your back. Like, you know, I totally support your Avengering. But yeah. She just like she acted as that reality check of like, no, just remember what you are and look at them. And then she's totally supportive of him. But I love the fact that this movie actually dealt with him being like, this whole thing is crazy. We're fighting a robot. I have bows and arrows.
Yeah, the fact that he says, like, I'm a guy with a bow and arrow, I'm like, yes, thank you for putting that out there.
None of this makes any sense.
He realizes that. I have to say, like, first of all, I think I may be wrong because there was a lot of, like, chatter and laughter going on. But I think Linda Cardellini does call him the Hawk Guy at one point.
Is
which,
that right?
Now I need to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure in that scene she says, you can't always be the Hawk Guy. And I was just kind of like, oh, that's awesome, because I think that was, you know, throwing that inside joke out there, which is fantastic. But I will admit this, I was not a Hawkeye fan for a long time. I never got why he was on the team.
You're one of those.
I was, but I have to say, you know, the movies do a great job of explaining it, but like if you're a reader And you want to, or a viewer, and you want to read some comics, I always recommend, if you're a new person, check out the Ultimates, at least the first two volumes by, or the first two Ultimates and Ultimates 2 by Mark Miller, because that does a great job of, like, for new readers, just introducing these characters. It's a bit over the top, but it also does
a bit.
Yeah, all right, a lot. But it also does such a good job of showing why these people are on this team and what makes them dangerous. And there's a scene where Hawkeye's whole shtick is that he's a guy who never misses. And there's a scene where he's captured or whatever, and, like, he was just like, oh, you idiots, you should have taken my fingernails, because he ripped off his own fingernails and used them as projectiles. Then he picks up two guns, looks at the camera, which is recording this, and just tells them, run. And at that moment, you realize, holy crap, this is not going to go well for any of those people, because you have a guy who never misses, and finally he has had it and picks up two guns. And it's almost like he uses bow and arrows as, like, to give his enemies a chance, almost, like, because God knows if he had a gun, it would be over. So I think, you know, there's a lot of awesomeness to Hawkeye that the movies pull out and show, and show why he's part of this team and what makes him great. And I think the human elements, even though he is the most human of all of them, were awesome to have him have that family, to have them have the concern about whether or not he's going to make it out of this. And then plus the jokes, the little things he does, the banner with Natasha, the moment where he was just like, he could joke about, you know, shooting Quicksilver in the back and no one would know, cracked me up, you know.
So great. Yeah. I do think this is a Hawkeye that this is a Hawkeye unlike any Hawkeye we've ever seen before. It's like, it's not the Marvel Universe Hawkeye, it's not the Matt Fraction Hawkeye, it's not the Ultimate Hawkeye. It's a, I think maybe more so than any other character, it is an amalgamation of all of those different types.
Yeah.
And I do like that. I think that in some ways, the whole point of Hawkeye is that you ask why he's on the team. Like, that is his, I think that is his defining characteristic. It sets up his, in the comics, it sets up his kind of, like, cockiness masking an inferiority complex, which is why he's such a sarcastic joker and why he tries so hard. And the most amazing Hawkeye stories are dealing with the fact that he shouldn't be doing this. And I loved seeing that in this movie. I love the speech he gives to Scarlet Witch. Both times I've seen it, it makes me cry because it is so amazing.
As I said, everybody, go watch a Marvel movie with Brett White. It's a great experience.
The fact that he gives her an out, he says, you don't have to do this. Your brother will come get you. This is crazy. He basically validates all of Scarlet Witch's fears and says, like, you're new to this. Like, you don't have to do this. This is insane. And then he says, but if you step out that door, you're an Avenger. And I'm getting choked up just saying the words. And then we get that amazing moment with her. I love
it. God mode activated, as I like to call it.
So, you know, I think that, you know, Kevin, you said the movies do a good job with Hawkeye. I don't agree with that. I think this movie did. I don't think the first one does a great job with him. I think a lot of people feel that way. Some people don't.
Well, he did get shafted in the first one, I admit. But the first one also set up that amazing moment where when Scarlet Witch tries to attack him, he's like, I've been mind controlled before. And he's the one who actually takes her down for a moment. So, you know. Yeah, I agree with you.
No, I think that that's great. But I think that this movie is the movie that really gives you a lot of Hawkeye. But for me, and this is something that we got written into about a lot. We got a lot of questions about this. I'll just quote Zach Brooks, who's one of the great hosts here on Post Show Recaps. He wrote in and said, "Were you like me, totally buying into the Hawkeye boot edit in Avengers? I thought he was going to die in the movie as soon as he told his wife it was his last mission. And plus, he got so much story and screen time. Also, had no idea his name was Clint." By the way, Jeremy Renner had no idea his name was Clint when he was first talking about being cast as Hawkeye. He kept referring to him as Clive. That's really funny.
That's awesome.
Like, yeah, Clive is such a great character. So you're not alone, Zach. His name is Clint, and Renner knows that now. But no, I think for me, watching this movie, the more screen time he was getting, and when he got set up with everything with his wife and his family and everything, it's like, oh God, they're going to kill Hawkeye in this movie. They're actually going to do it. Did either of you think that this was going to be it for Hawkeye?
Yes. Well, so the thing was, right before that thing happened, I remember, I think because Scarlet Witch's big moment comes right before that. And when that happened, I was like, Quicksilver hasn't gotten that. And then I was like, Quicksilver hasn't been in this movie that much. He's only had like a couple lines and hasn't done much important. Oh no.
No, I had it. I had a feeling, because that's the thing. I said it before. Like, I definitely thought it was equally likely he was going to kill Hawkeye, or Joss Whedon was going to kill Hawkeye, and not. Because Joss Whedon, it's like watching or reading Game of Thrones with George R. R. Martin. Joss Whedon will indiscriminately kill people, and you never know if he's going to or not. None of your heroes, almost none of your heroes, I guess. I guess it's different for the Marvel movies, but watching like Buffy and Angel, none of your heroes are safe. Your main character can die.
Yeah,
and
I believe he hates this reputation. I don't think I don't think that he likes this reputation that he's the guy that kills your darlings.
Well, I don't think. I say he's the guy that kills your darlings,
He doesn't have to like the reputation for it to be true.
It makes good storytelling, though, right? Like George R. Martin himself said, it is like when you read Game of Thrones and his stuff, you will fear for your hero because it's the one instance where you know maybe your hero won't make it out of this. Like, you read other stuff, you're like, the hero prevails, he'll be fine, he's fighting 20 people, he'll be fine, he's a hero. When you watch Joss Whedon stuff and when you read George R. R. Martin books, you're just like, oh god, this could be it, he could be dead right now at the end of this. And more often than not, that does happen, right? So I mean, it's I think that's, you know, Joss Whedon has a lot of reputations. He has a reputation for that. He has a reputation for writing great female characters, and he responds to that question, you know, you keep asking me this, that's why I have to keep, you know, doing it, so to speak. But he's also a phenomenal storyteller, like Brett said. I think there's so much that he does really, really well. And yes, this is the thing that kind of gets pulled out, as he always does this, but I think that's a credit to his storytelling ability that we care when it happens. So,
right. Yeah, well, you're talking about George R. R. Martin in this context. I think that it's only appropriate that we bring in a question from someone named Kingslayer, and it's on the topic of death in this movie. It's about Quicksilver. Kingslayer writes, why would they kill off Quicksilver? With Infinity War allegedly using a B-team of Avengers, why wouldn't they want to include Quicksilver? It seems like he'd be a great fit, but more importantly, Inhumans. We know his importance to that story. Why? And there's a lot to unpack in that question that maybe people are like, Inhumans? What's that?
Crystal, Luna, no.
But I feel like the most important question there is why, and I think it speaks a lot to what you're saying, is it keeps you on your toes. And it's one thing to kill Agent Coulson off in, you know, the first Avengers. That's a big moment. He's been in most of these Marvel movies up to this point. It's very sad. Never mind that he's going to come back in his own TV show. It still shows you that there are stakes here. But when you're seeing that, it's like Coulson can die. Coulson isn't, you know, a character with decades of comic book history to his name. Quicksilver is, and he's just being introduced in this movie. So no, it's not Hawkeye that goes, even though maybe the edit, as a lot of people who are listening to this would probably refer to it as, you know, the edit is certainly making you think that Hawkeye is probably the guy that goes. It ends up being a blindside. It ends up being Quicksilver. And I think the why is a lot of, you know, that George R. R. Martin and Joss Whedon, you know, method of storytelling of you got to believe that your heroes can die. What impresses me is that Marvel has the guts to pull the trigger on a character that they could, you know, if they really wanted to slash had time to, which they probably don't have room on the schedule, they could do a Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch movie and it would probably be awesome. But they take one of those toys off the table. And for it to be, you know, a fairly close to A-list, if not A-list superhero, and to kill them in this movie, in the only Marvel movie that they've been in so far, if you're not counting a post-credit scene, it's ballsy.
I do think that it, I think the why also is that it subverts the T word, the trope of fridging, because in this movie, Quicksilver is fridged for Scarlet Witch. His death is what like drives her to go hunt down Ultron and rip out his heart and then join the Avengers. Like, Quicksilver's death is in service of Scarlet Witch's character development, which is a thing that we never see happen with male characters, which I think that Joss Whedon is the kind of guy that's like, yeah, I'm gonna subvert that trope.
Right.
And I think that it makes Scarlet Witch a much more fascinating character. She has a really interesting arc in this movie. And I can't wait to see her in Civil War because of that. And I also think that Quicksilver is more marked for death because when you think of Avengers, Scarlet Witch is one of the like first three to five you would think of. Quicksilver,
as a comic book fan.
Yeah, as a comic book fan, like Quicksilver's history with the Avengers, like he was on the team for like 100 issues. And then after that, kind of off and on, you know, kind of equally associated with the X-Men.
Well, like his father, he is a on again, off again villain. So there's that.
Right.
And like his father, he's an on again son of his father.
Yeah.
Brother.
Let's not even talk about that.
Well, I think it's worth talking about just from kind of the boring behind the scenes reasons is so Quicksilver might be familiar to people people who don't read the comics but see superhero movies because he's in X-Men Days of Future Past. He's played by Evan Peters from American Horror Story in the first Kick-Ass movie, and he's not that in this. It's a different character.
It's a different guy from the Kick-Ass movie.
Yeah, it's Kick-Ass. Now Kick-Ass is playing Quicksilver. So you've got two Quicksilvers in two different movies. The X-Men movies are separate from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which owned is all the Fox. Avengers movies. Yeah, the X-Men movies owned by Fox, but Quicksilver is one of this weird loophole characters, one of the few where, since he has history as an Avenger but also has history as an X-Man, can be in both Fox and can be at in the Marvel Studios family as well. And I feel like it was a bit of drama when it was clear that Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch were going to be in Avengers Age of Ultron, and then very quickly Bryan Singer and Fox announced, well, we've got Quicksilver in our next X-Men movie too,
literally within a week. I was editor at Splash Page at the time, and that was like a hot week. Because like Joss Whedon was like, we got a very powerful set of twins in our movie, and it's like, oh, it's Scarlet Witch and Hawkeye. And like 2 days later, Bryan Singer's like, proud to announce Evan, and everyone was like, what does this mean?
I really wish there was a photograph of my face when Fox made that announcement, because it was not surprised. It was just like, yeah, this seems about right.
Right. I think that the point that I'm trying to make is that, he's this character that has kind of murky, rights issues around
him. Do you think that played into the fact,
I think it's a lot of we don't necessarily need him. We can use him, but we don't need him going forward. Look at who else we've got on the list. If Whedon and if Marvel and Disney, if they want to make an impact with killing off a name hero, they can kill Quicksilver and basically say, all right, X-Men, you can have him. You can have him. We killed our Quicksilver. It's not going to be an issue moving forward, and it's still going to surprise the crap out of people. So I think that's kind of a behind the scenes reason I would theorize as to why Quicksilver is the one who dies here.
Because do you think if Quicksilver wasn't in Days of Future Past, do you think this would have still happened?
I don't know.
Who knows, right? We'll never know.
I would expect probably, yeah. I don't feel like this is like a spite move. I just think that when they're looking at the characters that they have, it's good for Scarlet Witch for Quicksilver to die. It really does great things for her character moving forward. As you said, it sets up that incredible moment where Wanda pulls out Ultron's heart and obliterates it, and she screws up as a result. Her vengeance clouds her mission, and maybe
she really loves her brother, so it's understandable.
She's the reason why Sokovia is going to turn into is going to be the meteor that starts dropping. So she's distracted, and it calls back to what Hawkeye told her of like, when you step out, you got to be an Avenger, and she takes that part a little bit literally in the vengeance scheme of things, and it's great because it, even though she wants to be part of this team and wants to kind of redeem herself for whatever she had done earlier, after this moment, she's going to need to be grounded. She's going to need some purpose now that her brother is gone, but she's going to need some training so that stuff like this doesn't happen anymore. So I think that Quicksilver's death, I think that there are practical reasons for why he's a character you can do this to. I think it'd be really a lot harder to do this to Hulk is like unfathomable. To do this to Iron Man is really difficult. I mean, like a Captain America and a Thor, maybe we'll find out at some point down the line that they aren't as immortal as we think. But I think that there's certain
contracts.
I think that there are certain characters where it's really difficult to pull them off. But Quicksilver is kind of in that area of like, we could do that. We could do it for practical reasons. But I think also for the character based stuff, made a ton of sense for them to yank him off. It lacks a little tiny bit of impact for me, just because I don't think that they did a fantastic job of servicing the character himself.
Right.
But I think that he falls in service to another character, and I'm good with it.
I will say this, though. I agree with everything you said, except the part where you said, I mean, on one hand, yes, they didn't service the character because he didn't have a lot of screen time and stuff like that. But as a person who saw both of them, and as a person who really likes Quicksilver, this movie was Quicksilver. Like, the X-Men movies was fun and cool, but this was Quicksilver. Like, the attitude he has, the way he talks, his impatience, that scene where they're arguing and he just runs over and disassembles everything. He's like, no, continue. I'm like, that is the most Quicksilver thing that's come out of any movie. So like, as far as a fan of that character, this movie serves that character. That was Quicksilver,
because he's an arrogant prick.
Yeah, I guess I wanted more of him being a jerk.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted him more being a huge jerk, because he didn't have that many lines. You're pointing out the fact that he was a jerk by action, which is something I didn't notice before, so that's cool.
Yeah, like a lot of times he's a jerk by action, which is very Quicksilvery, but it's a weird balance, right? Because in this movie, they knew when writing the script what's going to happen to him, so they have to have both his jerky side and his, you know, sentimental side, which does exist. It takes a while to really see in the comics, but they had to execute all in this one movie. And I think they did it because you care when it happens, because it's heartbreaking when he dies. So
right. Justin Holcomb wrote in, he asked, would this movie have been better with Evan Peters as Quicksilver, or if they had slowed things down like they did in X-Men to show his effects better than the blurs that we got to see? Kevin, I'm assuming that your answer to this is no, because you think that the Aaron Taylor Johnson Quicksilver is truer to the Quicksilver in the comics. But I guess a riff on Justin's question would be, is there anything that they could have done to make him a better character in this movie? You were pretty satisfied with him. Brett, were you satisfied enough, or was there more that the movie could have done to make you invest more in this movie's Quicksilver?
Comic book Quicksilver has two hair tendrils that go to the opposite sides of his head. And this movie didn't have that.
This is the kind of thing that that you really latch onto. It makes me love you very much.
I wanted more of him being an arrogant jerk. Just more of that. I do think that Aaron Taylor Johnson is a better cast. Evan Peters wouldn't have worked because he does not look the same age as Elizabeth Olsen. So they were believable as twins. Like, physically, he looked more like the character. I do think that X-Men Days of Future Past used his power better, but I think after seeing that, like, Joss just, he couldn't do that again. So we got a couple of moments of, like, slow-mo, like the cat punch on the salvage ship. We got a couple of those, but, like, Bryan Singer did it really well.
He
had to do something different. He had, like, this weird, like, blue energy that, you know, kind of, like, blue energy smoke that, like, flew around with him.
Yeah,
it's interesting.
I really did enjoy the moment where they're going to have to start evacuating the city. And he like comes into the police station and tries to tell everybody, like, get out, city emergency, you got to save everybody. And then no one's doing anything. And then he runs back in with an AK-47, just blasts it. And he's like, let's go. I thought that was a good jerky Pietro moment.
Yeah, that's great. Good.
All right. One of you guys, whoever wants to volunteer for this job, help out Zach Brooks and a bunch of other people who are wondering the same thing. Zach wrote in, were Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver's powers caused by being stuck under the Stark missile? And I think the answer to that is no.
No.
But
no.
Where do they come from? Because I guess another thing that I would ask you to accomplish here is, what are Scarlet Witch's powers? Because
it's easy for this movie to find it.
Oh, easy for this movie.
They're loosely defined in the movie. They're loosely defined in the movie, I think, for people who don't know the characters necessarily very well. And where the powers come from, I think, is also a little bit murky. I think that speaks to the idea, Kevin, that you spoke about how Marvel isn't spoon-feeding you this type of information. They're asking you to go and look it up or to intuit a lot of this stuff. This might not be easy for a lot of people to intuit. So, Brett, do you have an explanation for this?
Guys, first of all, do not look up the Scarlet Witch's comic book powers. Don't yet. Wait. In the promo materials for this movie, they said, like, Scarlet Witch has telekinesis and mind manipulation, and that is it. Which is like, oh, great. Awesome. And that's what she does in the movie. The comic book Scarlet Witch, oh boy, has vaguely defined hex powers that cause, like, bad luck. And then later that evolved into, like, molecular manipulation and reality warping, which, holy crap, too much. They don't do a good job of explaining where they get the powers from. That is the thing that they just say, like, it comes from the scepter.
Well, they sort of did. They said they volunteered for experimentation. So, Baron Strucker basically experimented using the scepter and other materials that they've discovered and find to genetically manipulate them until they got powers. So I think they're like,
but they're inhumans, right?
Well,
no,
no, I thought they were. They didn't say it. I mean, I thought that would be the easiest thing, especially with all the stuff Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is doing
and
now.
And what are inhumans in the context of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Brett?
Oh, dear God.
it all makes my head hurt. Thousands of years ago, the Kree, which is what Ronan the Accuser was, the bad guy of Guardians of the Galaxy, they made like a station on Earth. And did like genetic experiments with humans, thus creating humans with like heightened genetics that had like powers. This was thousands of years ago. Then like the Kree hightailed it out of here, basically, after like setting up some temples and things that all got buried. So the Inhumans are now like the descendants of those original experiments. Over the thousands of years, like, that gene has become dormant in a lot of people. Some people like naturally manifest powers. And then if you're watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they've... God, this is so complicated. You're just like listening to me have a mental crisis. There's a thing called the Terrigen Mist, which is, I guess, like inhuman dust that if people with those latent genes breathe it in, it activates it. Which is what has happened to Sky.
Right. So this is the Marvel Cinematic Universe's answer to mutants, which are the X-Men, which are belonged by Fox.
They belong to Fox.
We can't use them. And traditionally,
I've read so many articles about this.
And traditionally, Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are mutants in the comics. I believe that's been retconned in the comics that they are now Inhumans. But it doesn't come up. The I word does not come up in this movie. I was surprised because Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the TV show, is setting that up. They're using the I word. They've got characters who are Inhumans on that show, and there's a movie coming up, Inhumans, in 2019, which is obviously a long ways away, but I was surprised that we didn't get into any of that here, and I think that maybe, you know, it is a convoluted explanation, as you very, very artfully demonstrated here, Brett, but it's, you know, I feel like for me, I was surprised that they don't go into any of that at all, because the power sets that we are seeing from the Maximoff siblings in this movie are weirder than what we've gotten from some of the other heroes on the Avengers. Like, everything else is like quasi scientifically explained. You know, Iron Man's got technological armor, and Captain America has, you know, a formula coursing through his veins. Thor is an alien. You know, there's scientific stuff with Hulk, but with this, it seems it's just not clearly defined, and that's one thing that I think was a little surprising. I think that that's also very, 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 very present in the weirdest character in the movie by far, the Vision. I think a lot of people are like, what is the Vision? What is up with the Vision? Kevin, what did you think of the Vision in this movie?
I really liked it. I mean, it's very weird because they made, I mean, I guess he's still the Vision, but he's a Marvel Cinematic version of the Vision. I actually really liked it. Again, that scene where he picks up Mjolnir is just such a powerful, powerful, powerful moment. So I think it was executed properly. I will say, definitely call from the trailer, because in the trailer they showed, you know, or one of the trailer, they showed him and they showed, you know, the gem on his forehead, which is from the comics that he has like a yellow little forehead thing. But I was just like, that is an infinity gem. Like, I was like, that is 100% like the soul gem or the mind gem happening right there. And so when it happened, I was like, oh, thank you. It all makes sense now. Especially since as a nerd, I was like, there's two blue gems? That can't be right. So when they revealed that there's a yellow one, I was like, oh, there it is. It all makes sense now.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has an infinity stone in his face, and that's gonna be very bad.
Oh, hey man, you got a stone in your face. Yeah, you might want to get that.
You might want to do something about that. Yeah, he's got one of these infinity gems in his forehead. That's pretty wild. He's got the voice and the attitude of Jarvis, which is by extension Paul Bettany.
Can we talk about that amazing casting coup 7 years ago that they did not know they did?
Yeah, talk about it.
They cast Paul Bettany, a high cheekboned, handsome Englishman, as just a voice, as just the voice of Tony Stark's AI, Jarvis. And then I think when Joss Whedon said, I think when he was doing Avengers, like, oh, by the way, you guys should introduce Vision and Paul Bettany should play him. Bye. And then he got to do it. Which is so amazing.
Yeah. This was he's talked about this a bit. Whedon has said that there were a few ideas while making Avengers 1 that he had for Avengers 2. Ultron was one of them. He wanted to do Ultron, and he wanted Vision, and he wanted Paul Bettany as Jarvis as Vision,
which is so cool.
Which he pulled off, and it's a really cool idea. Brett, who is the Vision for people who don't know who this character is? You know, this is the first time a lot of people are experiencing this character. Who is he from the comics, and then as best as you can explain him in the context of the movie.
All this stuff is so complicated.
Yeah, you give me all the heavy lifting. This is, first of all, I want everyone to know that, like, the versions you're getting in the movies are somehow simplified from the comics. Okay, so in the comics, this is like digging the Avengers brain. Hank Pym, who you will see played by Michael Douglas in Ant-Man later this summer, he creates Ultron in the comics. And then Ultron, in turn, creates his own android, Vision, which he does that in the movie. In the comics, though, Vision's brain patterns, his mind, is copied from Wonder Man. not Wonder Woman. Marvel has a Wonder Man.
Yeah, we don't need to get too deep into Wonder Man.
And that is why it gets, because then from there, Ultron then creates a bride for himself who has the Wasp brain, and Wasp is Hank Pym's wife, like the family tree of all these guys. And then like Scarlet Witch falls in love with Vision in the comics, and then later on falls in love with Wonder Man, whose brain is the same as the Vision's. Like,
very incestuous.
It's insane.
Once again, we're back to Game of Thrones.
Yeah, between the Ultron family and the Summers family, it's a goddamn mess.
Just don't even try. So in the comic, in the movie, they simplify it so much by being like, his brain is this computer program that you've seen in like five other movies. Done. He has it because of the mind gem. Done. He has a cape because Thor gives him life and he's like the first person he sees. And so he thinks everyone has a cape and he makes a cape for himself. And it's like, those are the craziest things about Ultron X, or about Vision, explained immediately. Very quickly, very subtly. I loved how they did that.
All right, let's talk about Vision coming to life. First of all, the mind gem. So the mind gem is one of the infinity gems that Thanos, the big purple bad guy at the end of Avengers and seen in Guardians of the Galaxy and seen at the very end of this movie in an amazing mid-credits scene saying, okay, fine, I guess I'll do it myself. He's going to be the bad guy in the next Avengers movie. He is after these gems of great power that we've been seeing in all of these Marvel movies in Thor the Dark World. But the mind gem, did we know that this was in Thor's scepter this entire time?
I think
Loki's scepter, rather.
Yeah. People suspected it.
Uh-huh.
Because he was able to brainwash people. Like in the first movie, we kind of suspected, oh, that must be the mind gem.
Right.
I will say all of the, like the Tesseract and that thing, like them not being spherical was like, nah, can't be a mind gem to me. Like not Tesseract and Aether, those can't be that. They're not round.
Right. And so the Tesseract.
I like your logic, Brett. That makes so much sense.
It turns out that the Tesseract, which is the cosmic cube that's in Loki's scepter, was hiding an infinity gem inside of it.
Well, no, because the Tesseract was a separate device in Avengers, because it was in the thing on top of the Tesseract was inside of that device on top of Stark Tower. And then Black Widow had to use the staff, which had the mind gem.
So is the Tesseract
is the space gem.
So that is also an infinity gem.
Yes.
All right. So this
is the Tesseract is the space gem.
This is terrific. Just to make fun of Loki for a minute. My good buddy Antonio Mazzaro, one of the podcasters here on Post Show Recaps, he's seen Avengers twice already. He wrote in and said, "Way to take the air right out of Loki. Dude had two infinity gems and couldn't do more than kind of threaten New York City when the Avengers weren't even an existing team. Puny guy." Indeed.
Well, to be fair, he wasn't working to do that. I mean, he was working for Thanos. It was his job to get those to Thanos, I think, at that point. Yeah. I feel like if he tried to use them, Thanos would have slayed the SmackDown right quick.
Whatever. Bad luck on Loki that he has two infinity gems. He can't do squat. And
I don't think, like, Loki also did not know that he had, like, a third of the most powerful things in the universe. And also, like, Loki doesn't dream big enough. Like, Thanos wants to rule the whole universe, and Loki was like, I just want a planet.
Yeah, he just wants a planet. All right, well, while we're talking about Asgardians, let's talk about Thor, and let's tie it back to Vision. Zach Brooks wrote in and asked, where did Thor go when he had the lightning strike him in the water? What caused him to come back and help create Vision? I felt like they were missing a few scenes. And I will admit that I'm a little confused about this as well. Can either of you explain, you know, where Thor went, what he saw, and why he comes back and is so fully on team create the Vision?
Which one do you want to take this, Brett, or should I?
I mean, I think that the movie does a lot of just like come along for the ride, guys, because They say everything so quickly and once. It's like Thor's like, this is a scrying pool from Norse mythology. Every realm has one. You use these to go back into your dreams and see them again fully. Okay, cool. And then he hops in. He sees, like, it's so fast.
So the pool is making him go back into his dreams.
Yeah, the pool, apparently. I have no idea about Norse mythology. If this is actually a Norse mythological thing, then like thumbs up Joss Whedon. That's awesome. But they say like every realm of the nine realms has one of these places. And I guess he went to Eric Selvig to track it down. And then his vision shows him. That's where he gets the info dump about the Infinity Stones. Because so far, the only people that know anything about the Infinity Stones are the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
And so now we are seeing the Avengers actually like being like, oh, hold up, guys. this is happening.
Right.
And so he says when he comes back and brings the vision to life is like, that thing is the mind gem. It is one of the six most powerful objects on Earth. We need it on our side.
And so we need to put it in the face of this robot thing that can now be our best friend.
Yeah.
Which I guess that makes sense to me.
Does Thor have any reason to think that it is on their side, though?
I don't know. I mean, this is the part that's confusing. I do think that the creation of Vision, if it's confounding for people who don't have as much comic book know-how as you have, Brett, and you're confused as well, I think this is one thing that maybe the movie did not explain super well.
Well, the movie, the thing that I noticed from watching it twice, the movie explains everything, but it is usually, really quick and layered under a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And or also a lot of context that you have to read into, which is my jam.
Right.
assuming things.
That's your face jam. But yeah, there's a lot with Vision that goes unexplained from how he comes to exist to why he is so firmly on our side. I mean, I guess you can take that from, he's got the goodness of Jarvis, the voice of Jarvis, certainly, but also a lot of his goodness, it seems like, and his kind of wide-eyed wonder skepticism of the world, but sort of an inherent trust in the beauty of his surroundings and things like that. But he also just has these insane powers. He can fly. I don't know that we see so much about him. Do we see a lot of his density changing in the movie?
I mean, just from his hard punches, one can assume he has heavy density. We definitely see him phase because we see him go through things.
Right.
Yeah, he can sticks his fist through an Ultron and then rips it apart.
He can go through things. He can shoot things with his eyeballs and his mind gem and all of this stuff. And he's got all this
energy. He's a Martian Manhunter of the Avengers.
He
really is.
he is basically a badass. He's a wise young lad. And he is
2 days old.
And he is 2 days old. No, he was born yesterday.
He was just born yesterday.
But again, from Antonio Mazzaro, who wrote in that he thought that Vision was pretty cool, but also a little super creepy. But Antonio says, but with an infinity gem and vibranium skin, isn't he just way too much of a badass to just be farting around with the Avengers B team? I understand in comics he's sort of a distracted hippie type character. Is this the way they can actually make obstacles seem harder to clear with Vision on their side? Because otherwise, he seems like a game over kind of weapon. Just thinking about the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and in about a year from now, we'll be talking about Captain America: Civil War. And Brett, you're kind of forecasting that based on the ending of this movie, the Avengers squad that's assembled involves Vision. It's very difficult for me to see how Vision exists, side by side with Civil War, with the tone of the Captain America movies. But I kind of share Antonio's concern of how it's just like he's so powerful. Like, isn't it kind of a game over type of thing?
Or
what are the obstacles you create with Vision to kind of temper that?
Well, first of all, two things. I think I don't know if his skin is 100% vibranium because it was mixed up with that fake skin. So it is possible that his skin is not as indestructible as Captain America's shield. Maybe. I don't know. That's theorizing.
Right.
But then also you see in Vision, in his first speech when he comes to life and they're asking about Ultron, he says I don't want to kill Ultron. He's sad. He's hurting, but his hurt will envelop the world. Vision didn't go along with that plan because they told him to. Vision went along with it because, he thought it was the good thing to do. I think an obstacle for Vision is the fact that I don't know if he can be swayed in a way, he has his own agenda.
Right.
And so far, he's on the side of life.
Yeah. To the point that he said, I don't want to kill Ultron. Ultron's unique. And he's basically says, but he has to be destroyed because of what he wants to do. But that line has led a lot of people to wondering. This is a lot of the fan chatter that I've been seeing. It's did Ultron actually end up getting killed? Did Vision actually annihilate him at the end of the movie in that scene in the forest? Which, by the way, is my favorite scene of the movie, is Vision and Ultron's final encounter. It's beautifully shot. The fact that the camera is pulled back so you don't see the actual impact of the blast destroying the final Ultron drone. Yeah. But that leads a lot of people that could be just an artistic choice, or it could be giving them leeway that Vision, who has said, I don't want to kill Ultron, has found some way of keeping Ultron alive somehow under his thumb. You know, there's interesting stuff. And I do think that that is one thing that's cool about Vision. He's so new. He's so specific. He's so deliberate in the way that he's thinking, that he is not thinking on our level. We know he's worthy. He's worthy enough to pick up Thor's hammer. But that could be worthy on a level that we can't quite comprehend as people. So I think maybe that makes Vision not just interesting, but a little dangerous potentially.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, he may be a powerhouse, but just ask him if God can make a sandwich so big even he can't eat it, and he'll just short circuit it, and there you go. Yeah. You beat the Vision.
And also the fact that he's gonna, I don't know, develop some feelings for a certain character.
Yeah, they kind of set a lot of that up. I really set all of it up.
Every time it happened, I was clapping in my seat, because the Scarlet Witch Vision romance is one of the weirdest things in the Marvel Universe, and they're going for it. And I am excited to see how weird it gets.
Yeah, yeah, that's very strange. That Vision and Scarlet Witch, they're going to be a thing. That's going to happen.
And it's set up the fact that she reads his mind and he saves her life. Like, they had a meet cute.
Yeah, every time it happened, like, it started with her and Ultron kind of being almost like her being interested in Ultron. So, like, they were definitely setting up her love of robotic men, it seems. And so I really was very excited, especially, again, when the Vision goes to save her. I'm like, oh, man, it's going to happen. It's happening. So I was pretty pumped about all of it.
Also, they killed Quicksilver, who in the comics was very disapproving of their relationship and did not speak to Scarlet Witch for a while after they got married.
Well, they will not be speaking for a while in this universe either.
Oh, aww, Josh, why?
We're back to the why question with Quicksilver.
Why?
So let's shift away from the new Avengers and the Avengers that are not used in as much in some of the other franchise films. And let's talk about the franchise players. Let's talk about Iron Man, Captain America, and Thor, who I think do kind of get in the backseat and let some of these other Avengers drive in this movie, in Age of Ultron. Kevin, what did you think of the use of Iron Man, Captain America, and Thor in this one?
I mean, I loved it. Like, at a certain point, you know, in the comic books, they do kind of fade onto the background as almost the leader types and sort of split apart at times. At the end of this movie, it seems Iron Man quit and Thor is off doing his own thing. So, you know, Cap is left to be in charge of these people. And that is a comic book precedent. That kind of happens. But I love their usage. I love their banter. It breaks my heart when they fight, mind you. It's almost like mommy and daddy fighting. It's very just like, no, stop, guys. So, like, I really liked it. And you know, I love Chris Evans. I love Chris Evans, but I also love him as Captain America. And it pains me to say this, but it's so accurate. As we've mentioned before, Superman's my favorite comic book character, and Captain America right now is a better Superman than we've seen. Like, he is the best example of Superman that's existed on screen so far, and he's just so good, and everything he does in this movie, like, I think is perfectly used. His fights with Tony is understandable because neither one of them is wrong or right, both have a point. And Thor, as he does a lot of times, exists in between. There's a scene where you see them walking and Thor is standing between Captain America and Tony, and I do not think that was accidental. I think that is deliberate, because Thor often stands between them, because one, he's beyond all of this nonsense because he's a god, but also he's a deciding factor whenever they have a fight. And so I really like all the usage of those characters and the way they played off each other and their friendship. It's just everything about this movie, even from just like a nerd perspective, as just watching it for like character work, is brilliant. Like, you talked about your favorite scene being Division in the Woods. My favorite scene was that party scene where they're trying to pick up that hammer.
Right.
Like, so much character moments in that one scene.
Yeah, we got a bunch of questions in from Ariel Kalish-Glassman that hopefully we've already addressed, but one of hers was, what did you make of Captain America being able to move the hammer ever so slightly?
Tears, so great.
Because that's an Easter egg from the comics.
Also, yeah, how great is Chris Hemsworth as an actor?
His face when it changes is so perfect. It's such a delightful moment where you're like,
the relief.
When he does it, like, all that stuff is just perfect, which is why, again, when the Vision picks it up, it's such a powerful moment. And it's fun. It's fun. I mean, like, I cannot stress how excited I am whenever fun enters these movies, because it's a moment to break up the darkness that sometimes happens. And your question? Why do I like them? Yes, I love it. I love those three characters. I love how they were used in this film.
Yeah. I also want to say that I want to commend Marvel as an amazing job at casting, because and that party scene is so key to that, because the fact that we got like Anthony Mackie and Don Cheadle and Kobe Smulders all in there with the main six, and just like, they all have effortless, endless chemistry with each other. Any combination of them, like, I just could watch Avengers, The Party. I could watch a 2-hour movie of that. I could. Of just those amazing actors all just like hanging out, cutting each other down, palling around. Thor and Iron Man both getting into an argument about which one of their girlfriends is smarter and more successful. I loved it.
Yeah. Well, so you know, I think that speaks to what's great about these movies. You know, you're not getting like the greatest, like the hands down definitively, these are the best special effects I've ever seen in any single movie ever in the Marvel movies. They're great. Don't get me wrong, but that's not the, you know, that's not the game changer. And it's not even the stories that are game changing either. I think the game changer and the reason why Marvel has been so successful really comes down to, you know, the casting, and also figuring out who the right writers are and who the right directors are, But really in a very obvious, you know, right in front of your face way, it's the casting. The fact that you have Mark Ruffalo playing the Hulk, that Robert Downey Jr., who really started this whole tone, who set this tone as Tony Stark, all of these people who come in, Anthony Mackie as Falcon, you know, you've got, I think in one of his interviews, Mark Ruffalo was saying, like, the reason why these Avengers movies are so great is because, like, it's all of these superheroes starring a bunch of people who are normally in indie movies, you know, and, like, a bunch of, who are like, what are we doing here? And it's this, what are we doing here, that really makes these characters work. You know, it's hard for me off the top of my head to think of like one casting clunker in the whole mix. I'm struggling to think of one in terms of like main important key casting of these characters. And I think that's the reason why we keep coming back to these movies. You know, it's the Easter eggs are terrific if you're a comic book fan, or even if you're starting to become more invested in this universe. The characters are fantastic, and you know, their superpowers are ridiculous, but it's really the actors are very, 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 very good. Just from like the subtle face shifts in Chris Hemsworth that you mentioned in the Thor hammer scene, you know,
Don Cheadle not be like Rhodey not being able to impress Thor and Iron Man with his story,
but being able to
impress
a whole bunch of casuals, you know, it's really good stuff, and I think that's pretty clutch in why these movies are doing as well as they are, and I think that's really in you know, it's, he's right there in the name of the movie, and we haven't talked about him much at all, is Ultron. You know, Loki, Tom Hiddleston is Loki, is one of the most beloved characters in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think that there's probably no one that creates as much of a wildfire on Tumblr than Tom Hiddleston as Loki. And I don't think that people are going to walk away from this one saying that Ultron is a sexier character than Tom Hiddleston as Loki.
Scarlet Witch might.
she might. but, you know, I've kind of bailed on the show, but I was a big fan of The Blacklist. James Spader on that show kind of just being like a cackling menace. James Spader, just a terrific actor from so many movies and shows over the years. And when he was announced as Ultron, immediately I just got it. I was like, this is going to be good. This is going to be very good. That's such a great outside-the-box choice, but it makes so much sense when you say it. I think James Spader as Ultron, I mean, it's hard to like rank what's the best, like, you know, casting decisions, not just in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but in this movie specifically. But James Spader as Ultron really did it for me. I gotta say, really did it for
well,
in a weird way. In
yeah,
kind of a weird way.
No, I will say this: like, I love James Spader in this movie. I thought the Ultron we were presented with in this film was great. It's not the Ultron from the comics, I thought it was great. And it's weird because I talked with my girlfriend about this. That when going in, you see that first trailer, you expect Ultron to be menacing and terrifying and just like this very dark, grim character in a way, but no, he's kind of glib at times and he's kind of funny. It makes sense because he's based off of Tony Stark's personality traits, so you're gonna have that, you have to have that Tony-ness, which I think that James Spader nailed with his delivery on certain things. So I loved Ultron in this movie. It's not the Ultron from the comics, but I still really liked him. Like, there's so many moments with him that had me cracking up in like a great way. I think in a way though it made him less terrifying and less menacing as a villain, but doesn't make him a bad villain.
It's just a kind of a blessing that a Marvel villain had a personality. I mean,
are you really that surprised? Magneto is like one of the best villains in existence, and like he has a personality. I think Marvel does a really good job with personality villains and characters.
Like, you mean the Marvel movies?
Yeah, because like, I mean, Obadiah Stane, Aldous Killian, Malekith. I mean, I loved Ronan. I think I'm one of the only people that actually think, like, Ronan didn't have a personality, but Lee Pace, like,
Oh yeah, he owned it so well,
so hard. I was like, I love this guy.
Agree, because he's Lee Pace, another great casting choice.
Controversial statement. This is why I like Iron Man 2, because I really love how off the wall bananas Justin Hammer and Whiplash are. They're crazy. They are cuckoo bananas, and I love them because they have a personality.
But that's it's rare ish. You know, I don't think that the Marvel movie villains are always fantastic.
Yeah,
no, it's true. I mean, like, I think what you said is true. I think Loki hits so well, though, because he has the most personality.
Like, and motives, and like, yeah, he's really good.
And he's beautiful.
Yeah, and I think, again, that's why Guardians works, is that everyone there had personality. But yeah, I think maybe when Marvel saw how well Loki did and realized, like, we need to change up our villains and kind of give them some personality besides, I'm evil! You know, so that's what we got Ultron, a different type of Ultron than we would expect.
Yeah. But I mean, and I don't want to get too into spoilers about Daredevil. But Daredevil, there's a lot of podcasts you guys can listen to with Kevin and I nerding out about Daredevil. And I know Brett, he finished Daredevil in a day. He was binging Billy to the max, binging.
Well, I had to do it for work. Yeah, so you go to CBR and read the Daredevil binge blog.
Yeah. So you could get Brett's thoughts on Daredevil as well. But and again, not to dig too deep into it, but one of the things that Kevin, you and I loved Wilson Fisk on that show.
Oh, yes.
Because one of the things that Vincent D'Onofrio did really well in that character and the writing for the character was just how much range he had as a villain. There were times where you were really on his side. There were times where he's, you know, really physically imposing and threatening. And then there's times where he's like kicking and screaming like a baby. And I think that they did a lot of that kind of work with Ultron in this. You know, there are times where, like, you understand Ultron's pain, you understand where he's coming from, where you know, he has his daddy issues. He kicks and screams whenever you bring up Tony Stark, to the point that, like, he doesn't even know his own strength. He'll rip your arm off by accident. R.I.P. Ulysses Claws' arm. and then there are times when he's just, like, physically intimidating. You know, his size speaks for itself. He's like 8 feet tall and is, you know, towering over Thor. That's says everything. So I think that there's a lot of range. He's very funny at times, you know, that whole, like, I'm glad you asked because I really want to just stand here and tell you all about my master plan. Or that other great
I love
line
where he's a Quinjet and he's just there and he's singing and then the Hulk comes in, you hear him go, oh, for God's sake.
Like, that's really good. Or when he says, like, if I could throw up in my mouth, I think I would, but I can't. You know, there's
when he's genuinely hurt when Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch leave. And then he kidnaps Black Widow just as he says, I need someone to talk to.
Yes, totally. So I think that they did a really terrific job with Ultron. You know, there's a lot to praise about this movie. There's a lot going on in this movie, as we've covered extensively. But I don't want Ultron to get lost in the shuffle because I thought that they did a really great job with him. And another reason why my favorite scene in the movie is his final scene with Vision is because, like, they're both such similar characters in a lot of ways. They're both new to this world. They're both just figuring things out, but they have such specific ideas of the course of the universe. And they're, you know, they're diametrically opposed, but not as opposed as Ultron's views versus the Avengers' views. Like, Vision kind of hovers somewhere in the middle, closer to the Avengers' side, but he can hear what Ultron is saying and, like, kind of talk it through with him and be like, no, dude, I get what you're saying, but I think the thing that you missed is that humans being kind of shitty is actually kind of wonderful. And like, it takes a moment like that, and it takes a character like Vision to come in, and, like, you can almost, like, see it on Ultron's ruined face there. He's like, huh, never thought of it that way. So I think there was a lot of really complicated stuff that was going on with Ultron. I think to springboard from that and to touch back to something you said a few minutes ago, Kevin, about how Captain America is almost a better movie Superman than movie Superman right now. And just to stick with the idea of, you know, this movie, it builds to this big, you know, climax where the Avengers are fighting a whole army of Ultrons.
I know exactly what you're about to say, and I agree.
They're fighting a whole army of Ultrons, but even more importantly is they're trying to stop Sokovia, which is being lifted off of Earth and is going to be slammed back into Earth as a meteor and repeat the dinosaur extinction event, or at least come close.
Hey, Josh, I have a question for you, by the way.
What's up?
In that scene, I just didn't want to forget it, when Ultron's just like, I'm going to raise up Markovia or Sarkovia and shoot it down. Did you have Final Fantasy VII moments? Because I did.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, that's going to go over everyone's head, but sure. But
even mine.
Yes. But what I'm driving at is this, you know, this whole big climax is a lot about stopping the Ultrons, but it's also about saving lives. And the great Antonio Mazzaro writes in and said, how great was that giant middle finger to DC Superman, his based mass murder of innocents vis-a-vis the Avengers' sole purpose in saving civilians on the floating city. Stark was freaking scanning buildings. Hell, they even saved the damn dog. Up yours, Supes. And it's true, you know, coming out of Man of Steel, you know, whether, you know, take you know, your opinions on DC versus Marvel, whatever. There's really no denying that Man of Steel deals with Carnage in a very different way than Avengers Age of Ultron did.
Or even the first Avengers, because like the morning after I saw Man of Steel, I wrote an essay on Splash Page just saying, like, in Avengers, the first one, before Joss Whedon had anything to react to, Joss made sure to show Hawkeye helping people out of a bus. You know, like, to show that there are real people being affected by this and the Avengers are trying to help. And then Man of Steel happened, and I guess Joss was like, oh, well, let's up that.
Like, well, I mean, I just love the idea that, like, I think it's Cap who says that the mission is to save the people. Like, the mission wasn't even to stop Ultron immediately. The mission was to save as many people, like, everyone off this thing.
So good.
And I think, it's just really important in that moment to show, like, you know, these heroes, they're trying to save people's lives, and that was the priority. And I commend Marvel. I never thought about it as a middle finger, and I don't know if it's necessarily a middle finger still, but I commend them for taking the time to be like, you know, these characters would care about that. Captain America would care about that. Like, that is his, concern.
When they're on the runaway train in South Korea and Quicksilver is running in front of the train and taking people out of the way of it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Such a great touch. Oh,
yeah, it's great. And, you know, I agree, Kevin. I don't think that it's, you know, Marvel intentionally, you know, flipping the bird at DC or anything like that. But having said that, you can do what you're setting out to do. You can have your story do exactly what it's going to do and kind of flip the bird at the same time. I think, you know, whether or not they meant to, it does wag a finger in the face of the DC, you know, movies that we've seen so far of Man of Steel, where Superman really is just knocking buildings down and buildings are falling and there's no attention paid to the casualties. And, you know, allegedly Batman v Superman is going to pick up those pieces, and that's going to be a plot point, is what the people behind that movie are saying, is that there will be people in the universe that are not thrilled with Superman because of that carnage.
He's a false god, Josh.
So I've heard. But, you know, reserve some judgment until that movie comes out and see how they deal with this idea. But I do think that that's one of the triumphs of the Avengers movies, is it is, as much as it's about, like, battling back these bad guys and their horrifying plans, it's as much about being, you know, the people who are defending the planet and defending the people who live on it. And I think that the climax of this movie did a phenomenal job at accomplishing that. I thought it was really amazing what they were able to do in this final act.
It's true. And I think, you know, you talked about the casting, right? Like, what Marvel has done, and I agree, like, they've cast perfectly, like, that they knew who the actors, how to cast these characters. But also, I think it's important because Marvel, the people who work on these movies are clearly got to be nerds, or I don't say nerds, comic book readers, and care about the characters, because when they write these characters, they're not writing for that actor. They're writing these characters. And I think that's so vitally important. The amount of people, like, because I love Chris Evans. When he was cast as Captain America, the amount of people I had to talk to about that was insane, because they were all like, that's terrible. He's just going to be a jokey guy. However, I'm like, Chris Evans is a phenomenal actor. I've seen him in a lot of stuff. He could do serious roles. And he did, and he nailed it. And he has never once been the goofy Chris Evans we see in, like, non-13 movie or even real life Chris Evans. And I think that's important, is that when Marvel cast him as Captain America, they made sure, like, hey, we're not writing you as Captain America, we're writing Captain America, can you play him? And he did. And I think that's very important for all this stuff. So when we see the climax of this film, we see the heroes all talking and reacting in ways that they do, they're still writing because that's how those characters would act. Hawkeye speech is Hawkeye saying this. It's important to note that it's not just, you know, they each have reasons for wanting to save these people, but it all is in line with their character. And that's what's important, I think.
Yeah. Past this point, this is something that Albert Vargas wrote in. Haven't seen it yet, but this will probably be appropriate. How about that extra scene after the credits? Did you think they were going to do that? The scene after the credits is Thanos putting on the Infinity Gauntlet and saying, fine, I'll go do it myself. After putting all of these pieces into position where he is trying to get the Infinity Gems, he's going to go out and he's going to go get them himself. How do you like that setup at the end of this movie? Do you think we're finally ready for Thanos to go up against Earth's Mightiest?
Well, I mean, it ain't going to happen for another, like, what, 2-3 years? it is interesting to know that this was a mid-credits scene. There was no post-credits scene.
Right. For the first time. Shawarma. No shawarma.
Yeah, which, you know,
this is a shawarma-free zone.
Yeah.
It was a little disappointing. I wish it showed them, like, eating some Sarkovian food at the end, you know?
It's a callback.
But the city blew up. I don't know.
Well, there was a rim. There was, like, you know, some neighboring neighborhoods.
I don't know. I was just kind of
like, oh, it's Thanos again. I don't know. I also don't have an affinity for the Infinity Gauntlet.
Womp womp.
like the Marvel Cosmic stuff I came into for the 2008 Guardians of the Galaxy series. So I don't have like that. Like when you love something when you're 10, you love it. I don't have that, like, I'm an 8-year-old reading Infinity Gauntlet and, like, nerding out love of that character. Well, so I was like, oh, okay. So like, if it had been, like, Captain Marvel or something, I would have lost my mind.
So what do you think in terms of where we're going then? Because that is where we're going. We're going to Infinity War. That's the next movie on the Avengers lineup, unless you want to count Captain America Civil War as Avengers 2.5. You know, the Avengers movies... It's a weird thing to say about a movie where they've been battling aliens and giant sky serpents and, you know, robots that have been activated kind of sort of by alien technology. You know, they are relatively grounded, but not really. But we are going into cosmic territory with Earth's Mightiest Heroes coming up. You know, that's coming up in a couple of years. Do you think that it's going to be... Is there such a thing as too weird? Like, how do we make that work? How do we throw Thanos at this version of the Avengers that we know?
Well, in my opinion, simple. It's exactly what they've been doing. They've been doing it slowly. By the time Thanos shows up, we would have Doctor Strange in existence, and we would have had Iron Fist, which, as I mentioned in the podcast, is a man who got his powers by punching a dragon in the heart. Whether or not they do that is up for grabs. We don't know if that's going to be it. But I think they've been going slowly. We've seen the teases of Inhumans and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We've seen, not even teases, they're the... But we've seen Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver, who have these gifts out of nowhere, quote unquote. And we have, you know, Doctor Strange coming with magic. I think they're teasing it out slowly, and they're building us to accept, yeah, when this stuff hits the cosmic scale, you know, it'll be there. That all said, dude, Talking Raccoon and Tree Man, everyone accepted that and loved
it.
Thanos is fine. It's fine.
I think I mostly sign off on that, but those characters haven't interacted with Iron Man. You know, that's
gonna be great.
That I think it'll be great, but is there any concern whatsoever that like we haven't attempted to bridge those two corners of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, on the same screen yet? I do wonder, is that too much for people, or is there no longer such a thing as too much?
I think that all that's fine. I think the only thing to worry about is that, like, people are saying this movie is overstuffed. And it's only going to get worse. There's absolutely no way that Avengers Infinity War is going to be, like, less than this movie.
Because it's true. There's going to be so much more.
We're going to have, like, Captain Marvel, Black Panther, Doctor Strange, probably even the Defenders, like Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist. They'll probably be in that movie, too, as well as the Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah. This, like, that's the thing. I'm wondering, I don't know, that... I know Marvel can handle, like, Thanos. I know they can handle, you know, Black Widow and Rocket Raccoon hanging out. I know they can handle all that. I'm more worried about handling so much movie, so many characters.
Yeah, that's a great point.
That's the only thing that I'm worried about.
We're talking about how the characters and how the acting has been such a strong point for these movies. But, you know, there's already, you know, we're already increasing the roster in this one, changing the whole face of the Avengers roster by the end of the movie. But presumably Infinity War is going to slam so many more heroes into the mix. And are we going to lose some of that characterization in the process?
Well,
we're also losing Joss Whedon.
I will ask you both this, okay? I know Josh, you're not into the comics as much, but just picture this, okay? So you're worried about whether they can fit all those characters. Imagine the scene at the end where Thanos is there, he has all these Infinity Gems, he has a gauntlet, and all of a sudden, the Defenders show up, the Guardians are there, Captain America's there, the original Avengers are there, the new Avengers are there, and at that moment, as they're about to face him for the first time ever on screen, Captain America or Iron Man actually says the words "Avengers assemble," and they all get together and fight Thanos. Do you give a shit anymore if those characters have meaning?
No.
because I don't care. Moment.
It's gonna be awesome. It's gonna be awesome. But I just want to make sure that Marvel doesn't lose everyone else. Like, it's awesome for me. Like, this movie is awesome for me, but like, I'm already bracing myself for the rest of my life having to defend it to everyone, just like I have to defend Iron Man 2 to everyone, which also has the same problem this movie does of being overstuffed. This isn't an Iron Man 2 podcast. I can keep going on about that, but I won't.
You'll never convince us, Brett. You'll never convince us.
It has nothing but great performances. It just has too much plot.
Yeah, I think
Rockwell's amazing.
He is. He's terrific. Justin Hammer's good.
So that's the only thing that I'm worried about is like losing. I'm also like really, really worried about this phase because Guardians of the Galaxy was kind of the only risk of the last phase.
You're talking about phase three that's about to start.
Yeah, the ones like this next upcoming phase is almost all risk. I mean, Ant-Man is a huge risk. Captain Marvel, Black Panther, Doctor Strange. These are all new. These aren't just they're doing, you know, the third Cap and the third Thor, but they're also doing these movies that are with characters that are like maybe slightly more well-known than Guardians, but still not to the, you know, it's interesting.
They've got to take these risks if they don't.
They do, 100%. Because you can't just keep seeing more Robert Downey Jr. movies. Like, he's going to get done with them. They have to introduce all these new characters. And I'm excited to see every single one of them. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be a wild ride.
It's going to be
wild, for sure. It's going to be a Mr. Toad's wild ride.
Yeah, indeed. Mr. Trope's wild ride.
Hey, don't say that word.
That's my word.
Some tropes are fine.
All right, well let's forecast a little bit. Let's look at Marvel's third phase. Ant-Man is technically phase 2, I believe. That's coming out later this summer. So setting that aside, what of phase 3? Which movie, if you got to pick one, which is the one that you are most looking forward to, starting with Kevin?
Captain America Civil War.
And why is that?
Because I've expressed my love for Captain America, but I mean, I will admit this. I am not a fan of the Civil War comic book and that like entire storyline. I find it crazy. There's a lot I don't agree with and just the way the characters acted. That all said, the precedent of the idea of superhero registration is a interesting and fascinating topic. And I think the Marvel movies will handle it very well. And I'm just excited to see these new Avengers because at the end of this movie, I got news and this is huge. I mean, like, it's there, but to me, I'm like, this is a big deal. We're looking at a team that has two females and two minorities.
Yeah.
When in the hell have we seen that before for any of this stuff?
There's only one white guy on the entire team.
Yeah. Like, and so, like, I am pumped for that fact. Like, the fact that that is here. And I'm like, oh, my God, thank you. Like, you know, I've loved everything before, but I'm pumped to see this. I'm pumped that, you know, diversity is a thing that's happening, you know. So there's a lot I'm excited for Captain America Civil War. Once that's over, I'll probably be excited for the next movie up. But, you know, it's that's where I stand right now.
Ethnicity is Vision?
Ooh,
yeah, he's a synthesoid.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's a whole new. It's like when if you look at Green Lantern, you're throwing in aliens. Now he's a completely different category.
He's a freakazoid.
No, that's a different character, Josh.
Oh, okay, Brett, I already know your answer, but maybe people don't. What's your answer? Which Marvel phase three?
Like Captain Marvel was my number one, and it's still like I'll still say it because Carol Danvers is a phenomenal character. The Kelly Sue DeConnick run is amazing. I love Kelly Sue DeConnick's Avengers Assemble run, which is, you know, Spider-Woman and Captain Marvel.
Are you
and
sad
Black
that
Widow.
Carol Danvers didn't show up at the end of this movie because in an earlier script version, I believe she was supposed to.
Yep. No, I'm fine with that because she does deserve to have an introduction. She's not a character you just throw in at the end of the coda at the end. I want to actually meet her. I want her to be a supporting character in another movie. Because I don't want an origin story again. I don't know. But also, like, seeing that end roster at the end of this movie, my excitement for Civil War increased by a billion because I have loved Don Cheadle and Anthony Mackie in their movies. So, like, they're so great. I love them both so much. I'm so excited to get to see, like, Falcon react to Vision. Like, even Rhodey's reaction to Vision, like, what?
Yeah, what the heck was that?
I just can't wait to see that. Ugh. But those are the two that I'm most excited for.
I'm now so much more excited for Black Panther because Andy Serkis has to come back as Ulysses Claw, and he was so ridiculous in this movie.
Andy Serkis is awesome. I mean, that man deserves an Oscar. The fact he hasn't gotten one yet is upsetting.
Yeah, for him.
But then again, neither has Leonardo DiCaprio, so here we are.
Okay. Yeah. Well, for him to pop up here in, how did you describe him, Brett? You called him like
he's like a buff bearded Brooklyn hipster South African talking salvage king. He has a weird accent in the
it's
movie.
So good. That's such a great. That just makes me really excited to see him again. He was really
so cut. Like he was just like his arms
And his hair and his Abraham Lincoln beard. I mean, yeah. It was just terrific. He was really good.
Unrecognizable.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a requirement to be that cut now, though, in Marvel movies. Like, if you're going to be a Marvel movie, you are required to be at a certain fitness level.
Except Mark Ruffalo, and that's exactly what I like. So.
Where are we going to see Mark Ruffalo again? This from Zach Brooks. Are we going to see him in Guardians of the Galaxy 2? That question, I think, coming from there were a lot of rumors that the next Hulk movie that we would see would be Planet Hulk, which is based on a comic book where Hulk gets rocketed off into space and becomes Russell Crowe as a gladiator on a planet filled with other alien gladiators, which is an awesome comic book. Does not appear to be what's happening in the movies.
Yeah.
And one of the rumors was that Planet Hulk, that storyline, was going to be the basis of the second Guardians of the Galaxy.
I don't
think that he's showing up there.
I don't think James Gunn would do that.
Do you think that we're not seeing the Hulk again until the next Avengers movie?
I think
we might not see the Hulk again until the final Avengers movie as a big return reveal moment, really. Yeah.
Okay, well then that speaks to what Mike R. had written in. Mike had written in, is this a good exit for Bruce Banner? I'd be okay with a cameo, but how much more can we really expect from the Hulk? This seems like a perfect send-off and lets us see more of the other characters. So the spirit of that question, I think, being are you cool with putting the Hulk on ice so that we can focus other people, or are you really going to feel the absence of the Hulk in the next couple of movies?
Yeah, but I'm like not a Hulk guy. I love Mark Ruffalo and I love the movie Hulk, but there aren't like Hulk stories or villains that I'm like itching to see on screen. I wouldn't mind it if they actually like brought Liv Tyler in for something. Like, the Hulk movie itself is so far removed from the rest of the Marvel Universe, I kind of wish that they would, like, bring Thunderbolt Ross in for Civil War. Like, play with some of the other supporting characters.
Right.
Hulk is an interesting... Like, Ruffalo even said Planet Hulk isn't feasible because Banner's only in it for, like, a minute.
Yeah, but they could change that.
Yeah, exactly. They could totally change that. But that's kind of the problem you get with Hulk is, like, everyone wants to see the guy he turns into, but, like, Mark Ruffalo is phenomenal and everyone loves him. So it's like you have to balance him more. It's just interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think they can definitely do I don't think we need to see it. I think when he comes back, like if he comes back, which he should at the big climax, if he is like, we don't have to see how the story unfolded, but if he comes back and he's actually in full control of the Hulk, finally, like it'd be an awesome reveal to have that moment of him showing up to save the day and he's in full control in his Hulk mode. It'd be great. Like, I'd love that moment. We mentioned Liv Tyler, who for people I guess who don't know, she played Betty Ross, the Hulk's main love interest in the Hulk films or the Incredible Hulk movie. Did you guys? And I didn't catch this until I read it. The Archie joke that existed in Avengers.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah,
I heard
that's
about it.
Amazing. Yeah. Like I love
Betty,
that.
Betty Ross being Bruce Banner's first love. Veronica being the name of the Hulkbuster armor that stops the Hulk. I think that was pretty good. That was pretty clever. We didn't even talk about the Hulkbuster fight, which I think just speaks to just how freaking much is in this movie. That like we could be talking for close to 2 hours now. We didn't talk about the Hulkbuster once. That's wild.
That scene, oh my god, the laughter in the theater, and rightfully so, where he's just rapid punching him and saying, go to sleep.
There's a lot of really great beats. Like, Joss Whedon is a master at timing. There's so many great pauses in that for jokes.
He's the Chandler Bing of directors.
Are you sad that no more Whedon after this? Joss Whedon directed and wrote the first Avengers, wrote and directed the second one. He seems to be dropping the mic after this. Are we going to miss him?
I won't, because I'm sure he's going to go on to do something more amazing, and I hope that amazing thing is another Firefly thing. So, hey.
And the guys that are taking over for him are Joe and Anthony Russo, the directors of Captain America the Winter Soldier, and also those screenwriters are coming along with him, and I think we all have positive feelings about Captain America the Winter Soldier. I actually think that if anyone can handle an overbloated movie, an oversized movie, and make them streamlined and work, it's those guys. I really think, because Captain America Winter Soldier, by all intents and purposes, it had like what, three or four villains, a main cast of like six heroes. Like, but it never once felt overwhelming. And so I really think that Joe and Anthony Russo are the perfect people to take over. And their tone is going to be so different too. We're not going to get, I'm excited.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Agreed. I'm really pumped for this.
Those guys have a lot to do. They have to do Captain America Civil War. And then from there, they got to do Avengers Infinity War, which is a two-part movie.
Great job.
That's a fantastic job.
What a great job to wake up to.
A lot of pressure though, man. A lot
so
of pressure.
Pressure, but also so much money, Kevin. They have so much
sure.
money.
So much money.
But it just makes me want to take a nap just thinking about like all the work.
You're tired for them? I'm you just want to go to sleep?
Well, I just like naps in general. So I think I just want to take
a nap. I hear that.
Anyway, let's put this podcast to rest as well. Let's start wrapping up here. As we said before, we are recording this on Free Comic Book Day, which is a terrific day where you can go to your local comic shops and you can get some sweet free comics. You should also buy some comics while you're there. Just verse yourself, you know, get well versed in some of the cool comics that are out there right now. But since many of you are probably listening to this after Free Comic Book Day, let's give some Free Comic Book Day advice. Kevin, where would you point to people who came out of Avengers Age of Ultron and want to read some more Marvel stuff, whether they're interested in what they got in Age of Ultron, you know, certain characters that were introduced, or they're interested in what's coming up down the line, you know, a Doctor Strange, a Captain Marvel. Where would you point some people next?
Oh man, that's so difficult. I actually did this for my girlfriend who wanted to kind of get familiar with Marvel stuff. I recommended, reading the first two Ultimate books by Mark Miller, and I think that's a good point of like a more realistic take on the Avengers and can get you familiarized with the characters. But if you're already pretty familiar with them, I would say the Marvel events start with Avengers Disassembled, jump into Brian Michael Bendis' New Avengers, and then from there you can go into like Civil War, you can go into Secret Invasion, you can read the X-Men stuff, I think is really good, that's going on at the same time. I would say stop at Siege and just kind of be like, all right, cool, but that would be
New
my
Avengers
recommendation.
New Avengers is a good book. New Avengers is a good overview because that has like all of the Netflix characters in it, but it also has like pretty much all the movie Avengers in it over the course of the run. Like it's very solid, I think.
What else would you recommend, Brett?
I think that Hawkeye, Matt Fraction and David Aja's Hawkeye and Annie Wu's Hawkeye run is really good because it is 100% standalone. You just go buy that hardcover and you can read that hardcover. I think the second hardcover is coming out soon. It is a joy. It is funny. It is realistic. It is sad. And it really hits on all the things that make Hawkeye great in this movie, except he is single and has a whole lot of really angry ex-girlfriends, which is great. And I also think that, if you just want a great Marvel book, go read Miss Marvel by G. Willow Wilson and Adrian Alfona and Ian Herring. Jeez, do that. I will also say Kelly Sue DeConnick's Avengers Assemble run, and also Al Ewing's run on Mighty Avengers. Those are very recent books, and they're the side Avengers books. They're not the main ones that are all tied up in events. They're the ones that are off to the side, and they have smaller casts of cool characters. Speaking to diversity, Mighty Avengers has like a 95% diverse cast. Like, I think Spider-Man's the only white guy on the team. It's all women. It's all like White Tiger, who's Latina, and also like four or five black men. So it's like, and Monica Rambeau, a character who needs to be in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They're great books. And Kelly Sue DeConnick's run in Avengers really plays up that fun, joyful, like ribbing dialogue that Joss Whedon has. It's a lot of fun. I love those books.
Sweet. All right. So lots of great comic book recommendations for you guys. We also, we could point you to some places that you could get some comics. You could go to comixology.com online if you're into the digital thing. If you don't know where a local comic shop is for yourself, you can go to findacomicshop.com. That's a comic book resources awesome resource where you could go and you could find comic shops as the URL suggests. So go and do that if you liked Age of Ultron. Go get into some of these funny books. There's lots of really good stuff going on out there. Brett, where can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter at Brett White. You can also just see me write things for comic book resources. I have a column pretty much every Wednesday. And also, if you like comedy, you can go to YouTube and search for UCB1. That's my fake comedy news team. We have about 40 videos up there. I did one about asking if Batman is a Republican or Democrat, and we held a real debate. So
no spoilers.
No spoilers. You'll find out what he is.
No spoilers. Kevin, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter at Kev Mahadeo. There's the podcast I did with you on Daredevil, which I highly recommend because we owe
the people a feedback show. That's going to come up. I'm kind of sick of talking to you, Kevin.
I can understand it. There's a lot of talk recently.
It's why it hasn't come up yet. But yeah, if you guys haven't watched Daredevil yet, you should watch the show and you should listen to the podcast that Kevin and I did. I thought they were really fun. Of course, you guys can follow me. I'm at Round Howard, like Ron Howard, but rounder. If you got to the end of this massive Age of Ultron podcast, give us a hashtag tweet. Let's go with it's a trope. Hashtag it's a trope. You can tweet that our way.
Make sure you don't put an apostrophe in there because Twitter won't recognize the hashtag.
Very good advice, Brett. I hope you guys enjoyed what we had to say about Avengers. Hope you enjoyed us nerding out about Avengers. It was definitely very deep divey, but I think that it was very fun for me to talk to you guys always. And hopefully you guys liked what we had to say. Let us know what you think in the comments section here on postshowrecaps.com. Subscribe to what we're doing on Postshow Recaps. postshowrecaps.com/iTunes is a great way to do that. And we'll talk to you guys again at some point. Thanks, Brett. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, Josh. Bye, Brett.
Bye,
Felicia.
Bye, Felicia. Bye, everybody. Bye.